Now to introduce tonight's speaker. After receiving a bachelor's degree from Grinnell College, Professor Smith went on to receive a master's and doctoral degrees in classical languages from the University of North Carolina and the University of Toronto, respectively. Following a 10-year period as a member of the faculty of the University of Notre Dame, she has since been teaching at the University of Dallas, where she now holds the rank of associate professor in the philosophy department. She has spoken widely on college campuses, to clergy and to the laity, and has addressed the U.S. bishops three times at Pope John XXIII Medical Moral Research Workshops. She has published extensively. She has authored or edited two books on Humani Vitae and has published scholarly articles on Plato, virtue, abortion, and contraception in various academic journals. Professor Smith is currently in the midst of a grand tour of the dioceses in the state of Ohio and has kindly consented to fit us into her very tightly packed schedule. We in the Guild are most pleased to be able to sponsor this segment of her trip and would like to welcome her here to our city. Professor Smith, we hope that your brief stay with us is a pleasant one and that there will be, as a result of your visit, a new and energized interest and understanding of the Church's age-old teaching regarding family and marriage. So without further delay, I give you Dr. Janet Smith.
Thank you. It's really very nice to be here. I grew up in Pennsylvania, in Warren, Pennsylvania. It's not so far away. And my mother grew up in Cleveland and my father in Ashtabula. So it's always nice to be around familiar terrain. It's somehow consoling. Okay. Now, as the doctor mentioned, I've written quite a bit on this topic. In fact, I think one book is 480 pages and the other one is longer. So that means I have a lot to say. That's not always good news for an audience, especially when you're seated in such hard seats there. And I do have a problem. I'm a nonstop talker, but I want you to know I belong to a support group. It's sometimes difficult to get away from that support group, but it's called the On and On Anon Society. Right? And they tell us at the On and On Anon Society to make certain that we don't go on and on. And one way of doing that is to capture our thoughts in some short, pithy statement. And I borrowed this statement from Garrison Keillor. You may know him. He's the radio humorist who does the Prairie Home Companion and talks about Lake Wobegon. He talks about Father Emile, who's the pastor at Our Lady of Perpetual Responsibility Church. And he gives a homily once a year on contraception. And it goes like this. It may take you a while to see what he's up to, but it's a one-sentence homily on the church's teaching on contraception. And it goes, "If you don't want to go to Minneapolis, what are you doing on the train?" Okay, think about that for a while. You'll have a whole hour here to think about that and get the gist of it. All right, so my topic tonight really is contraception. The church is teaching on contraception, various sexual issues. There's a great connection here between the many sexual issues. And as you know, we live in a culture that thinks that contraception is one of the greatest inventions in the history of mankind. If you were to ask people if they wanted to give up their car or their computer or their contraceptive, it'd be a hard choice to make. It's really considered to be something that's really put us greatly into the modern age, and again, one of the greatest advances of modern medicine and modern times. And there's this archaic church that tells us that really this was one of the worst inventions of mankind. It's one of the things that's plunging us into a kind of a disaster. So you have this great polarization, a world that thinks it's one of the greatest things going, and this church that says it's one of the worst things going. And I'm going to try to help people see tonight why the church's teaching certainly deserves serious consideration. And what most people don't know is that every Christian church up until 1930 taught that contraception was wrong. So a universal teaching within Christian churches. And it was only in 1930 that the Anglican Church first broke with that unbroken tradition and approved contraception within marriage for serious reasons. In 1931, Pope Pius XI wrote the encyclical Casti Connubii, which is usually translated On Christian Marriage. And there he reiterated what had been the constant teaching of the Church. And within the Catholic Church, there was virtually no debate on this issue until the mid-1960s. Really, you can date it to about 1963. And there was really a great acceptance of the church, those in the church, of the teaching of the church. In 1960, some 66% of Catholics were living by the church's teaching. 66%. And now they say some 80% of Catholics are contracepting. 30% of Catholics are sterilized, which is the same rate as the rest of the population. And they say some 4% of Catholics are using natural family planning. I personally think that might be a high estimate. So how have we, in the last 30 years, gone from 66% compliance to, at best, 4% compliance? Partly what I want to look at tonight. Well, there's a couple reasons I'll give you right away why in 1960 it seems that 66% were compliant. One is that there really weren't very good contraceptives at the time. The pill was not yet really on the market. It had just begun to be developed, right? And most contraceptives were illegal in most states, at least for interstate purchase. And those laws that made contraception illegal were really put on the books by Protestant legislators, right? Contraception was always seen to be the source of great sexual license in society, and considered to be something that a morally upright side society would ban. But as you all know, because of the doctrine of the right to privacy found in the penumbra of the Constitution, those laws were thrown out in the early 1960s. And that was really the precursor to Roe versus Wade. That right to privacy is found in Griswold versus the state of Connecticut, and then is reiterated in Roe versus Wade, which legalized abortion. It was also at the time that, for Catholics at least, obedience was considered to be a virtue. It was not yet seen to be a pathological condition. So Catholics were prepared to accept what their church taught, simply because it taught it, in fact, whether or not they understood it. Now, in the 1960s, the pill became available, and that's really where the revolution in contraceptives began. Again, it was considered to be a great salvation of mankind for several reasons. There was the beginning of the belief that we were headed for a disaster as far as a population problem was concerned. In fact, when I was in high school, we had posters of globes with human beings falling off the globe. It was so crowded. But there actually have been no two people who have been more wrong than Malthus and Paul Ehrlich. You can look this up. You can read the literature on this. I recommend books by one by a man named Julian Simon and another man, Ben Wattenberg, who are demographers, and there's many others, Jacqueline Cazoon, who have looked at their work. Malthus said that the population would increase geometrically and the food supplies would only, at best, increase arithmetically. The population has increased enormously. But the good news, and that's not necessarily bad news, that's just a fact, it has increased enormously. The good news is that the food supply is wildly better off than Malthus ever dreamed. The United States could quite easily feed the rest of the globe. It's not a problem. Modern agricultural techniques have exponentially increased our food supply. And they say we haven't even begun to mine the ocean for food. And as far as for limited mineral resources and that sort of thing, Malthus thought we certainly would run out of coal and run out of copper and these sorts of things. But we actually have more coal and more copper now per person on the globe than Malthus thought we had at his time. We've discovered more resources, and we need them less because we have such things as atomic energy. So I'm not here to argue against the population scare. I'm just here to tell you that there's good reason to doubt it. And you might wonder why we see these emaciated children on TV starving, and why this is something, gosh, we must be overpopulated. Look at all these starving children. Has little to do with population, really. Has a great deal to do with one tribal or ethnic group hating and starving out another tribal and ethnic group. Has a great deal to do with corrupt governments and the failure to distribute food. Has a great deal to do with natural disasters that we can have little control over. But that was one of the reasons that we thought the pill was going to be a great thing. Was going to help us with population problems. And the second thing was feminism. There was a rapid growth in interest in feminism, and certainly we had to have contraceptives because women couldn't get in the workplace and find their fulfillment unless they were having fewer babies, and the only way they could have fewer babies is with a better contraceptive. It was also believed that contraceptives, especially the pill, would make for much better marriages, because clearly people could now use contraceptives within marriage and have We get rid of the fear of pregnancy that was dampening the spontaneous and blissful sex lives that spouses hoped that they could have. Take the tension out of the sex life that was there because of a fear of pregnancy. And it didn't take people long to catch on. Well, gee, if you could wipe the fear of pregnancy out of sex within marriage, you could wipe the fear of pregnancy of sex before marriage. And surely it would make sense to have sex before marriage. I was a teenager in the 60s, and this became to be the wisdom of the times. Surely none of you would buy a car unless you took it for a test drive. It's just as idiotic, of course, to get married without having sex with your prospective spouse. And none of you would really buy a car without test driving several cars, right? That would also be idiotic. You want to find out what model you like, right? You want to see how it drives. It's the same thing then in the 60s. We were actually, this was wisdom at the time. It was, the earlier generations, it was unfortunate. They more or less had to restrain themselves before marriage and sort of plunged into marriage because they were desperate for sex. And now we could be free from that kind of desperation by having sex outside of marriage, making a calmer, cooler, more collected assessment of our future spouse by being able to have a sexual relationship before marriage. This was considered to be great wisdom. And of course, we thought there would be an enormous decrease in the number of unwanted pregnancies. Surely contraception would help people not get pregnant when they didn't want to get pregnant. And concomitant with a decrease in unwanted pregnancies, there would surely be a decrease in the number of abortions. Now, these were the expectations for the contraceptive pill in the 60s. And I think none of these were stupid expectations. It seems to me on the surface there's a great deal of logic to this and a great deal of plausibility to these expectations. But the Catholic Church at the time said, no, that won't be the case. It was in 1968 that Pope Paul VI issued Humanae Vitae. Looks like some of you might have been alive and aware at that time. You might remember that it felt like a bomb on the church and the rest of society. It was a shock to everyone that the Catholic Church reiterated its constant teaching against contraception. And Pope Paul VI, in section 17 of Humanae Vitae, made several predictions about what would happen if contraceptives became widely available and widely used in society. He said, first of all, that there would be a general lowering of morality in society. Now, for those of you who are here in the 60s and a lot awake and aware and are here in the 1990s, I don't know that I have to do a lot to convince you that there's been a general lowering of morality. I remember watching TV when I was a teenager in the 60s. We saw Donna Reed's show, I Love Lucy, Father Knows Best, you know, the Spin and Marty show, all sorts of great family entertainment. And now I can hardly watch the advertisements on TV without being offended, let alone afternoon soaps, which are surely soft porn, let alone the talk shows that introduce perversions into my mind that I haven't even imagined, okay? Let alone MTV, which approaches being hardcore porn. I call this the frog in the water effect. Some of you might have heard this story that is useful. If you put a frog into boiling water, it will actually jump out. But if you put it in a pot of lukewarm water and gradually raise the temperature to boiling, it will quite happily boil to death, right, and not notice. And I think that's what's happened to us. In the 1960s, my father and every other father on the street, I think, would have taken the TV and smashed it on the pavement if MTV would have come into our homes. And now we're quite happily boiling to death with the TV that we have. Not to mention, of course, crime in the streets, not to mention drive-by shootings, not to mention gangs and all the things that we're all frightened about. You might say, how can you trace any of that to contraceptives? And I'll do it for you in a minute. But first I want to go through his predictions. Secondly, he predicted that there would be a general lowering of, or a general disregard for the physical and psychological well-being of females by males. Again, I think pornography is a great assault on a woman's psychological and physical well-being. There seems to be an enormous outbreak of sexual abuse of women. The statistics are just overwhelming for how many women have been sexually abused by someone in their household. Not to mention the fact that 60% of the poverty in the United States is accounted for by single women with children. Most of those living in poverty in the United States are single women with children. And that seems to me to be clearly psychological and physical abuse of women. And how did that happen? How did they get, how do we get all these single mothers with children? I'll talk about that in a minute. The third prediction was that governments would use family planning programs for coercive purposes once contraception became widely available. And it's outrageous what's going on in this world. Some of you have been watching the deliberations of the UN, highly backed by the United States, to say that all economic aid to third world countries will now be tied to aggressive population programs. These countries must have aggressive distribution of contraceptives, sterilization, and ready access to abortion if we are going to feed and take care of the poor. I don't know if you've seen this in the news, but it's been in the Catholic press, that the women delegates to the UN are outraged at this. Right? They find this insulting and demeaning, like they're being treated like breed cows. What they want is better prenatal care. What they want is better medical care. What they want is more access to education and food for their children that's not tied to contraceptive programs. And some of you may know, be familiar with the work of Stephen Mosher. It's very well documented that there are forced abortions in China. In many areas of China, if a woman has more than one pregnancy, more than one baby, the second pregnancy will be forcibly aborted. Women are actually dragged out of fields late in a pregnancy and forcibly aborted. Now, we've all lived through several weeks of seeing a national outrage because an adolescent is being caned in Singapore as a great violation of human rights. But do any of you hear or have you seen any sort of national outrage for what's going on in China? Pope Paul VI's fourth prediction was that would we begin to treat our bodies as though they were machines, right? Would no longer have respect for the human person as an integral unity of body and soul, but the body would now be a machine that we can do to whatever we will. Now, there's no greater evidence than that than our use of reproductive technologies, of surrogate motherhood, for instance, and many of these in vitro procedures. Some of you are caught onto the story around Christmas time of a 59-year-old woman in England who conceived a child through in vitro fertilization. Now, Irma Bombeck said this would never catch on. She said that 59-year-olds will leave a baby in a room and forget where they left it, or show up at a high school graduation and not know what they were doing there, or why they were there. But the point is that any woman can buy a baby. Any woman can go to an in vitro clinic and simply buy herself some semen and get herself impregnated and get the kind of baby she wants. It gives a new meaning to the word designer genes, right? If you want a Nobel laureate, you go to Stanford. If you want a hot whiz kid from MIT, you go to a clinic outside of MIT. You want an East Coast Ivy League whiz kid, you go outside of Harvard. And you can buy yourself a baby. Married, unmarried, homosexual, heterosexual, any woman can do this who has the money. Tell me we're not treating our bodies like machines. What about the other predictions of the secular world who thought contraception would be so great? What about this prediction that marriages would be better? I think in some respects marriages are better. But the divorce rate shows us that there are a lot of very bad marriages, or at least marriages that end because people think they're very bad. In fact, the divorce rate doubled between 1965 and 1975. The divorce rate had been sort of sneaking up all century long. Until the mid-1960s, it was at 25%. And then in 1975, it got up to 75%, 50%. And so in a short 10-year period, the divorce rate doubled. And there's a demographer at the University of Stanford named Robert Michaels who was kind of intrigued by this. And he wondered why it was that the divorce rate doubled in a 10-year period. And he actually discovered that as the contraceptive pill became more and more available, that line was parallel to the parallel of the divorce line. And in about 1975, 1976, when every woman who wanted access to the pill had it, that's when the divorce rate leveled off. So in his statistical scientific investigations, he's discovered three reasons why he thinks the use of contraceptives have contributed to this massive increase of the divorce rate. He says he can attribute 45% of this increase to increased use of contraceptives. These are his reasons. There are three. I think there's others, and I'll also try to explain his. But his first reason is His first observation is that the statistical data shows that those who use contraceptives have fewer children and have them later in marriage. They have fewer children and have them later in marriage. And his statistical data shows that those who have a first baby in the first 2 years of marriage and another baby in the next couple years of marriage have a much longer lasting marriage than those who don't. Now, I'm sure everybody here in this room can tell me of someone they know who's been married for 25 years with 8 or 10 kids who's gotten divorced. And it's all very sad, but that's the rarity. It's the rarity. His data shows that those who have babies sooner in marriage have a longer lasting marriage than those who do not. And I'll give you about 3 seconds to figure out why. All right, he gives no explanation. I think there's several. One is that, again, some of you look like you've been around for a while. Some of you are actually pretty newly married. And it might become clear to you, for as blissful and as happy as those early years of marriage can be, they can also be very difficult. You've got two people with different habits and different expectations and different modes of communication trying to build a life together. And I've noticed with my friends who are newly married, at some point in that first year or two, it seems that one or the other gets in a car and goes for a drive and around the block and around the highways, and you don't really know if you're going to come back. Right? You're pretty darn mad about something. But if Junior's in the house, all right, there's somebody's smiles you don't want to miss in the morning, right? So you go back, right? And you work it out with the person you're mad at. There's two people in the house you love. One you're mad at, and the other's the smiles you can't think of missing. If you have another child, there's two people whose smiles you really want. One you're mad at. You may love like crazy, but you're mad. But you go back, and you work it out. And that's very important in marriage, to work those things out early in the marriage. I think it's also the point that people who have children become better people, I want to say, almost instantaneously. Almost instantaneously, they become better. It's been my good fortune to have met several of my male friends as they've exited from the delivery room. And some of you may have experienced this and seen others. Such individuals are generally delirious, right? And they babble. And they say things like, it's incredible. It's the most miraculous, marvelous, mysterious thing I've ever been a part of in my whole life. It's the best day of my whole life. I just can't believe it. And somewhere along the line, they say a phrase. They say, everything's different now. Okay? They say, everything's different now. And that's absolutely true. Because yesterday, they could care less who the mayor was, or who was the chief of the police force, or who was president of the school board, and whether the playgrounds were safe, or how they spent their money, or how many movies were rated PG, and what was on TV. But today they care, right? And today everything's different. And now they're going to be careful about all of these things. Because when you're single, who cares about these things? It doesn't affect you. When you don't have any children, it doesn't affect you. When you have a child you're sending out to the world, all of a sudden you become protective of this child, and you know that all these influences need to be attended to. You also become more patient, generous, and kind, and hardworking, right? Because this baby is very demanding. It takes a lot of your time and a lot of your effort. And to become a better person, you're married to a better person. And that makes for a better marriage. So that's his first reason. Those who contracept have fewer babies later in marriage, and their marriages are weaker. And it seems clear to me why that's the case. Secondly, he says, since contraceptives have arrived on the scene, there's much more adultery than there was before. I'll give you 2 seconds to figure that one out. People have been tempted for the history of mankind, right? And it's easy enough to think about wanting an affair, but wanting a child out of wedlock is another story. But if most every woman is contracepting, then most every woman is available in a certain sense. And there's no real reason to say no. And adultery is absolutely devastating to marriages. The third explanation is that women are financially more independent. They do have fewer children. They do go into the workplace. And again, when they have difficulties in the marriage, it's much more easy to say, take a walk, than it is to work it out, because they need their husband for one fewer reasons than they did before. Now, I think there's several other reasons why contraceptives are damaging to marriage. It's hard to get really clear statistics on this, but just recently in the USA Today, I read that one poll shows that 37% of high school students are sexually active. Another said 57%. I saw another that said that 87% of college students have been sexually active. I think most of you know there's very few people who are going into marriage as virgins anymore. they're hired to find. And I think all this sexual activity for marriage, before marriage, is not good for marriage. Most people have been lied to at some point. Most people have made promises and broken those promises, and had promises made to them, and those promises have been broken. And they're marrying someone who has lied and made promises and had promises broken. And they don't trust each other quite as much. They don't even trust themselves quite as much. I've said these things before. I've made these commitments before. Can I keep them? He said these things before. He's made these commitments before. Can he keep them? And I've seen lots of people actually just slide into marriage. This whole notion that by having sex before marriage, you could make a better choice of a spouse, I think is absolutely erroneous. It seems to me that the sexual passion can obscure things rather than clarify things. You get used to the sexual relationship, and it kind of makes you ignore whether this person is selfish or lazy or egotistical. Things that another 2 years from now might really bother you. Right now, because of the sexual relationship, you overlook these things. I had a friend who was had this boyfriend for whom there was an enormous sexual attraction between the two of them. And they did start to have a sexual relationship, but found out that it was making both of them quite miserable. But they couldn't really get away from each other. That relationship went on for about 5 or 6 years, even though they lived on opposite coasts, and they would telephone each other and have these very heated phone conversations. And at one point I asked her, I said, are you going to marry this man? This is just going on forever. Been more or less not seeing anybody else because he's been in the picture for the last 5 or 6 years. And then she finally said, well, you know, I just couldn't see him being the parent to my children. I couldn't see it. I can't see that. He's crazy, right? We have very different values. I'm a committed Catholic. He hates Catholicism. And when she said this, she finally realized she had to break it off. But that sexual attraction and attachment for years had obscured this until she finally figured it out. And I've seen a number of people who lived together before marriage. And a matter of fact, cohabitation is one of the real clear signs that a marriage isn't going to work. I heard a statistic the other day, I'll have to check it out, but a priest told me that he did a workshop in his parish on cohabitation, and in his studies he discovered that 75% of those who live together before marriage, not have sex together, but live together before marriage, get divorced within the first 3 years. And I've seen people who do this, you know, they're 25, 26, 27, 28 years old, they've been living together for 2 or 3 years, and everybody's bugging them, why don't you get married? So they ask each other, well, why don't we get married? You know, they figure out they're not fighting that much. And they certainly don't want to start all over again. I mean, this last 2 or 3 years was hard enough, and who wants to start all over again? And you might just as well get married. It seems to be time. And that's not the best path into marriage. So it hasn't made for better marriages. So has it made for fewer unwanted pregnancies? The statistics on this are wild. In 1960, some 6% of white babies were born out of wedlock. 6%. In 1992, 22% of white babies were born out of wedlock. Almost a fourfold increase, and it's rapidly rising, rapidly rising. In 1960, some 22%, same figure, 22% of black babies were born out of wedlock. Anybody know the statistic now? The percentage? 68%. 68% of black babies are born out of wedlock. That took 30 years. I don't think it will take 30 years for the 22% of whites to go up to 68 if we follow down the same path we are currently following. Now, here's my connection. First of all, the world tells us that if we have more and better contraceptives, we can solve these problems. There will be fewer unwanted pregnancies. But the point was, in 1960, again, there was almost no contraceptives available, especially to teenagers. All right, you had to know some tacky gas station somewhere and have a few quarters, and that's about the best you could do. But any teenager now can get a contraceptive from their guidance counselor, in fact, from some welcome-to-school kit in some schools, right? I mean, we live in a culture in which condoms can be handed out in schools and Bibles can't. And I think that tells you everything you need to know about our society. So it seems to me there's clearly more and better contraceptives aren't going to help. Teenagers have incredible access to them. You know, but teenagers are just as good at using contraceptives as they are as making their beds and doing their homework and doing their chores. Have about the same degree of reliability. I used to help with I set up a pregnancy help center actually in South Bend, and would talk with these young girls and we'd ask them, did you use a contraceptive? And they would say, no, I wanted to buy a Prince album this month, and I had to use my money for that. Or, I didn't like the side effects, so I stopped. Or we broke up, and I thought we weren't going to see each other again, but he came around again. And they get pregnant, right? And they're surprised. And, of course, we have 1.5 million abortions a year. And how did these happen? 50% of women who go to abortion clinics tell us that they're there because of contraceptive failure. 50%. 80% tell us that they are contraceptively experienced. They know all about it and they've used it before, but again, for one reason or another, they've stopped. But the real point, in my mind, is that contraceptives have launched people on a lifestyle that makes for sex outside of marriage, makes for sex in which babies and bonding are not welcome likelihoods. Right? And when they happen, disaster strikes. People now say they're having sex outside of marriage and they get pregnant. What do they say? They use this wonderful phrase, I got pregnant by accident. And I always am kind of mystified by this phrase. I say, how did that happen again? See, I'm kind of naive, but I caught on to this some time ago. And I know you can't get pregnant by accident. You can get hit by a car by accident, and fall off a cliff by accident, but you can't get pregnant by accident. It actually means that something's gone right with an act of sexual intercourse, not that something's gone wrong. But because people are using contraceptives, they get pregnant. Oh, they're surprised. My gosh, you got pregnant. We didn't have that in mind. That wasn't a part of this picture. So we have to do something about it. What do we have to do? We have to trot down to the abortion clinic. Now, I will give you the highest authority of our land, right? The Supreme Court says so. All right, there's an article out there I wrote that's on the table you can have for free. It's called The Connection Between Contraception and Abortion. Now, I cite Planned Parenthood versus the state of Pennsylvania versus Casey. And in that decision, this is not quite verbatim, but it's close. It says, in several important respects, the decision to use contraception is the same as the decision to abort, or the decision to have an abortion is the same as the decision to contracept. And it goes on to explain. It says, for 2 decades, couples have based their intimate relationships on the availability of abortion should contraceptives fail. For 2 decades, couples have based their intimate relationships on the availability of abortion should contraceptives fail. Now, in this whole Supreme Court decision, which is on abortion, there is not one mention of the humanity of the unborn child. Not one mention of whether the fetus is a person or not. It's not even dismissed as a question. It's not even considered. But it does say we must have abortions because we have contraceptives. It's a necessity. For 2 decades, couples have counted on it should their contraceptives fail. The Supreme Court says so. Okay. Now, again, I think in the 60s, it was not a stupid expectation that contraceptives would make for better marriages, fewer unwanted pregnancies, fewer abortions. But I think the cultural evidence today shows absolutely the contrary. And it's very hard for us to see because, again, our culture, our president, his cabinet tell us that more and better contraceptives and more and greater access to abortion is absolutely necessary in this society. It's a good thing. Now, the church said otherwise. As I told you, Pope Paul VI didn't predict this in great detail, but he certainly predicted the broad strokes of what happened. And you might say, how did he see it when the rest of us couldn't, right? How did he see it? What did he know that we didn't know? Well, he had a whole history of the church behind him, some 2,000 years. And some of us, of course, believe he had the guidance of the Holy Spirit and he couldn't miss, right? Because he wasn't using human wisdom here. Human wisdom showed something quite different. And I don't think that human wisdom was implausible, but it's turned out, I think, to be dead wrong. What did he know? Well, the church has always based its teaching, not on something private to Catholics, but on what is known as natural law. And then I'm going to give you about a three-minute course here in natural law. Right, natural law says that if you want things to prosper, you have to use them in accord with their nature. Right? If you want things to prosper, you have to live in accord with the reality or the nature of the things that you're using. If you want to grow good tomatoes, you have to treat tomato plants in accord with their nature. You have to give them sunshine and water and fertilizer and a good soil. And if you want your car to run, you have to put oil and gasoline in it. You can't put your tomato plant in the closet and expect it to grow good tomatoes. You can't refuse to water it and expect it to grow good tomatoes. You can't put molasses in your car and expect it to run. And the church has said human sexuality has a certain nature. And unless you live in accord with that nature, chaos will result. You won't get your tomato plants and you won't get from here to Cleveland, right? It won't work if you don't live in accord with the nature of it. And the church says, and it says that this again is not revealed wisdom. This is something that man can discover by the basis of his own reason if he's not obscured by his culture, which we are. But if you strip away our cultural conditioning, I think you can see this. You say, what is the purpose and meaning and nature of sexual intercourse? It seems to me it's quite clear. It's for two things. It's for babies, and it's for bonding. And that's what happens when you have sexual intercourse. You have babies, and you bond. And my view is if you don't want to have babies and you don't want to bond, then you shouldn't be having sexual intercourse. And my view is that the babies and bonding that comes with sexual intercourse belong only within marriage. And I would love some rap group to put together a little song for me on this, you know? If you don't want babies and bondings, you shouldn't be having sex. You shouldn't be having sex if you're not married, because that's where babies and bondings happen, is appropriate. Now again, we have a whole culture that says having sex and having babies and making bonds are two different things. Absolutely two different things. Having sex, you say, I want to have lunch with you, I want to play tennis with you, I want to go to movies with you, and I want to have sex with you. No big deal, right? It's a contraceptive that allows me to do this. Again, if I find myself pregnant, I'm shocked. If I find myself attached to you, I'm shocked. We all know all these really wonderful women who seem to be attached to these terrible men. Say, how does this happen? She can't let him go. She's engaging in sex with him. That's bonding. All right? So our society has this view that these two things are separate. The church says, no, they're together. Now some people want to say, oh, no. You've left something out here. Clearly sex is for pleasure. And those who are having sex are doing what sex is for. They're having pleasure. I would say, no, you've missed the point. Okay? That there's lots of things that have pleasure attached to them. Pleasure is not the purpose. Pleasure is the motive, and pleasure is the consequence, but it's not the purpose. As a matter of fact, God attached pleasure to the things that he really wants us to do, that are necessary for our survival and for our happiness. So it's pleasurable to eat, and it's pleasurable to drink, and it's pleasurable to sleep, and it's pleasurable to exercise, and it's pleasurable to have sexual intercourse. It's pleasurable. That's not the purpose. That's not the reason we eat, though some of us do. It's not the reason we sleep, though some of us do. But that's not the real purpose for these acts. They're restorative in many ways. Right? They're necessary for our survival. So God attached pleasure to everything he wanted us to do for our salvation, not our salvation so much as just our well-being. Right? But we have to do it at the right time, in the right place, in the right manner, with the right person, etc., etc. In the right way. Sure, eating is pleasurable, but there's limits to what you should be eating. Sexual intercourse is pleasurable, but there's limits to what you should be doing. And you have to seek that pleasure in accord with the nature and reality of what you're dealing with. Now, in many ways, the modern world is completely at odds with the church in viewing these things. Again, we live in a culture in which human life is considered of absolutely insignificant value. Otherwise, we would not be able to have abortion clinics. Right? My students, University of Dallas, are wonderful students. It's a good Catholic school. We get wonderful students. But they are as confused as the rest of the world about these things. They absorb as we all do. Every one of us absorbs the views of our culture. And my students, I was teaching one at Darwin one day, and I was making the point that human beings are radically different from animals. We may share common characteristics, but there's things that we can do that are so far out of the reach of animals that it can't even be compared. And afterwards, this one young girl came up to me and she said, Professor Smith, I don't see why you're so obsessed with the difference between human beings and animals. They're just not really all that different. And I said, all right, let me try to help you see this. So I did a kind of a far side thing for her. You know, I said, have you ever gone home and found your dog, you know, painting the ceiling of his doghouse like the Sistine Chapel? She said, no, I've never seen that. You know, have you ever caught your cat, you know, pounding out a Mozart sonata? She said, no, never seen that. I said, you know, you don't even catch pigs playing rugby, which is at least a minimal human activity. And she said, no, I've never seen that. And I said, well, now what? Think about it for a minute. I said, why do you think they don't do this? And she said, because they're just not interested. Otherwise they would. I mean, surely I could do these things if I were interested. But anyway, she's with our society on this. This is what we think, that there's no big differences between human beings and animals. We have a whole animal rights movement now where save the baby whales. But human beings can be taken into an abortion clinic and terminated. Right? Now, it's on this point of the value of human life that you can see this huge difference between the Catholic Church and the rest of the world, or Christians in the rest of the world, or most religious traditions in the rest of the world. Right, because we see every human life as a new soul that God has brought into this world. It's meant to exist with God for an eternity. You see, we don't really see human life as our culture does. Our culture now thinks, you know, of course people can have babies, that's okay. We somehow have this primitive need to reproduce ourselves. So it's all right to have two. You know, you certainly, we can understand you wanting your boy and your girl. We understand that. But you have more than two, and everybody begins to look a little bit suspiciously at you. What are you doing? I mean, we now think of babies really as environmental hazards, right? As little threats to the rainforest. I mean, my friends have told me that they're pregnant with their third child, and the nurse receptionist will say, Mrs. So-and-so, your pregnancy test is positive. Do you plan to continue this pregnancy? Right? Do you plan to continue this pregnancy? Or Mrs. So-and-so, would you like to schedule a tubal this time? Because surely you and your husband aren't going to have more than three. Or here's a stack of pamphlets that you get when delivering your third on different contraceptives. Because obviously you and your husband don't know what you're doing. You need some help here. And those who have a third child or more will tell you that in elevators or in doctor's offices or in grocery stores, people will approach them and say the most astonishing things. Don't you and your husband know how to control yourselves? Lady, are these all yours? Or how many are you going to have? And they're just astonished that anybody would want more than two children. You're allowed to have three if your first two are girls or first two are boys, because obviously you want your boy and your girl. But more than three is just, it's out of sight in our society. But of course, the Christian view is not this. The Christian view is that the whole universe actually exists for us. It's our support system. We're supposed to be here. All right? God made the universe for human life. And he wants souls. He wants lots of them. Go forth and multiply and fill the face of the earth. Go forth and multiply and fill the face of the earth. Now, a little piece of evidence for this is that most women will tell you that their greatest sexual desires are when they're ovulating. Just like God giving them a shove in the back, right? Go for it. This is what we want here. Nature's way. God made nature. Right, now, this is the most amazing thing when you think about it. This is amazing. You know, a sperm, this little sperm, it does not have an immortal soul. All right? The little sperm does not have an immortal soul. It has a short and sometimes very happy life, but it does not have an immortal soul. And the ovum, you see, it does not have an immortal soul. It can have a short and happy life, but it doesn't have an immortal soul. And when the two come together, where does that immortal soul come from? The sperm doesn't carry it. The egg doesn't carry it. Where does it come from? It comes from a new act of creation by God. In each act of conception, there needs to be a new act of creation by God. One of my priest friends says that when new human life is created, the whole universe is changed because something has come into existence which did not exist before and will exist forever. It's just like when God made the whole universe, he made something from nothing. And now he's made a new soul from nothing. It didn't exist. There's not a whole group of souls out there that are sort of waiting around for a landing place. God actually performs a new act of creation. So when male and female participate in the sexual act, they have opened up this arena which God has designed for bringing forth new human life. And when they contracept, they are slamming that door in God's face. They're saying, we want to enjoy this pleasurable act that you gave us, but we do not want to let you perform your creative act. Now, I'm not saying that couples who are contracepting are conscious that this is what they're doing, but this is what the act itself means. It's much like drinking a little bit of poison in your orange juice. You might not know it's there, but it will have its effect on you. Right? You're not intentionally doing that, but that's what the act itself means. So in the first place, the church objects to contraception because it refuses to let God perform his creative act in the arena in which he chose to do it. You know, God could have created new human life in different ways. In fact, he has before.